Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is Brian McClanahan again, and today we're going to talk about the 1860 election and what's often called secession winter. So what we're going to do is discuss what happens in 1860, and this is really, I think, a misunderstood election by most Americans, and then the outcome of that election, and meaning that not just who wins, because of course we all know who wins, but what are the results, what's going to happen because of that particular election and the results of that election. And in so many ways, this is really a watershed election in American history. It's a turning point. It's when the United States goes from the Union of the Founders to this recreated Union that we're all living in today. So without a doubt, if you had to pick maybe a couple of important presidential elections in American history, this is going to be number one. And of course, the man who wins is often seen as the most important or most important man in American history. Some would classify him as the greatest man in American history. I, however, have a little different perspective on Abraham Lincoln, and so do a lot of other people. And I think some of this negative impressions of Abraham Lincoln are starting to gain traction in the United States, but it's going to take some time. You know, when you have a monument to Lincoln in Washington, D.C. that, you know, thousands of people visit a year, and there he is looking, you know, stately in his chair for eternity. It's very hard to get rid of that image that Americans have. Of course, he saved the Union too, and but what does that mean? I think most Americans don't realize the Union that he saved was not the Union of the Founders. And even at that particular time in between 1861 and 1865, there were thousands of people that were saying the same exact thing. Abraham Lincoln is not a saint. Abraham Lincoln is not a great president. Abraham Lincoln is not the guy that we all think he is. And so we're going to look at that in a little more detail. Of course, I'll conclude this presentation ultimately, either in part one or part two, with the firing on Fort Sumter and then the results of that. And then, of course, ultimately, we'll look at how Lincoln prosecuted the war. And some of the things he did there that were drastically unconstitutional. In fact, people were calling him on it then. And, of course, most of the time, this is just swept under the rug today because Lincoln is some demigod that all Americans should worship at the altar of. And I think that's a particular problem in American history. But last time we talked, we were wrapping up the 1850s, and we were getting to the 1860 election. So let's talk about that 1860 election. By far, this is the most contentious election in American history. It's not a mudslinging election, so to speak, as we would think of today, where you have two candidates and they just bash each other constantly. This is a contentious election because you have four major political parties vying for the presidency. We've never really had that before since, or even before. Before this point, you generally had a couple of front runners. By the time you start getting political parties, you're still going to have a couple of front runners. After this point, maybe the 1912 election where you have three candidates and then Eugene Debs as a socialist, perhaps that was a similar situation, but all those people were progressive, so they all thought generally along the same lines. Here you have four major candidates that don't see eye to eye on much of anything. Perhaps the Democrats on some issues, but for the most part, these four candidates are unique. So let's talk about what's going to happen here. Of course, for the Republicans, you have Abraham Lincoln of Illinois, the guy that made a name for himself running against Stephen Douglas in 1858 for the Senate seat of Illinois. He's really an upstart and not a guy that has a great national reputation. And of course, he's not going to have much of a following outside of the North. Then, of course, you have the Northern Democrat candidate, Stephen Douglas of Illinois. So Illinois has two candidates in the election. Douglas, of course, as I mentioned before in the last presentation, had soiled himself, so to speak, in terms of the possibility of becoming president by a support for the Freeport Doctrine, or at least coming up with the Freeport Doctrine, still supporting popular sovereignty, even though theoretically Dred Scott had put the idea of popular sovereignty to rest. So he is going to be the Northern Democrat candidate. The Southern Democrat candidate is John Breckinridge of Kentucky. He's vice president. And this guy gets support from the South, of course, as the name mentions, Southern Democrat candidate. Now, what he's going to say is that he's going to support the Dred Scott decision, that slavery extension of the territories is constitutional, that you cannot deny Southerners their rights in the territories. And so essentially what happens here is that you have a number of Democrats who are going to say what's going on with the Northern Democrat Party, and of course the Republicans, is unconstitutional and should not be supported. This is the only guy in their mind that supports the Constitution as ratified in 1788. And finally, you have the Constitutional Union candidate, John Bell of Tennessee. This is a conservative party. Essentially, what you have here are old Whigs, people that are trying to get together who aren't comfortable with Republicans in the North, and some Southern Whigs, of course, and have a party that's going to adhere to the Constitution. At least that's the way that it was sold. They're not going to have the same type of support as the other three candidates, but John Bell does have an impact in the election. Now, as I mentioned before, Douglas is extremely unpopular in insisting on the Shreveport Doctrine and on popular sovereignty. The interesting thing about this idea of slavery in the territories, you know, it's completely rhetorical. In fact, in the entire Western territories in 1860, there were 20 slaveholders and 46 slaves. So think about it. If this is a slave power we're talking about here, as the North likes to say, it's a slave power looking for extension. We're talking about 20 guys and 46 slaves. It's not even worth cutting your finger over and bleeding over. This was a rhetorical issue for the North. It was a principal issue for the South. And so really, again, what you have, this is why, again, Avery Craven called these people the blundering generation. There's not a whole lot going on here in terms of a real concrete issue. Northerners aren't concerned about the plight of these 46 slaves. They're concerned about their political power. Southerners aren't really concerned about having cotton plantations out there. They're worried about the principle behind this. What does the Union actually stand for? I mean, these are important things. I'm not going to minimize that. But again, Stephen Douglas insisting on the Freeport Doctrine and popular sovereignty, Southerners know full well that's not going to work out for them. Northerners know full well that this is just rhetorical, that they're able to use this slave power thing they keep beating on like a drum to hurt the South, and that's pretty much it. I mean, there's not any slaves, so to speak, out in the Western territories. Again, this is rhetorical. Now, once it became clear at the Democrat convention that Douglas was going to get the nomination, this convention was held in Charleston, and it was a contentious convention. There were fights. It was a real raucous time. Once it becomes clear that Douglas is going to get the nomination, Southerners bolt the convention and form their own party. In fact, there's no consensus in Charleston, so they're going to have another convention in Baltimore. The idea was to try to bring the party back together. It doesn't work. So Democrats are going to split their party in 1860. Northerners are going to nominate Stephen Douglas. Again, coming up with this playbook where you get a Northern nominee. Hopefully you'll get the Southern vote. It's going to be locked solid and you'll get Northern votes. It doesn't work out here, though, because Southerners are not going to support Douglas. If the Democrats had selected anyone but Stephen Douglas, anyone who supported popular sovereignty, they probably would have maintained a cohesive party and probably would have won in 1860. But because they don't, the Democrats are going to lose this election. So John Breckinridge is going to be nominated by the Southern Democrats. What's interesting about that, you know, you think of the South, the man who presided over the Southern Democratic Convention was James A. Byard, the younger, of Delaware. So, in 1860, when we'll talk about this, and Delaware staying loyal in the Union, that wasn't necessarily certain as secession winter carried on and went forward. Now, the Republicans, again, are going to nominate Abraham Lincoln. And Allen Nevins, a great historian, oftentimes not always right, but he was very, very popular and wrote some pretty good histories at times. This is what he said about the Republican Convention of 1860. He said it was like any thus far known in national history. It was greater in size and enthusiasm and noise and wire pulling and self-righteousness and lust for office and its blend of mass hysteria and idealistic fervor. So you think about that, this Republican convention. Think about some of the terms he used there. And self-righteousness and lust for office and mass hysteria, idealistic fervor. Sometimes these things are very, very dangerous. Lust for office? Now, the founding generation, of course, considered that an evil, lust for office. And here we have the Republicans lusting for office in 1860 and self-righteousness. That's a very dangerous thing to have. You're right, everyone else is wrong. You're pure, everyone else is evil. That can be a pretty terrible thing for a country if you have a group of people who are self-righteous and indignant. And where's the union in that? I mean, these people are right, you're wrong. There's no union there. It's my way or the highway. And that's essentially what's going to happen with the Republican Party. Now, Lincoln, of course, was a compromise candidate. He had few political enemies, which is why William Seward is not going to get the nod. The guy had too many political enemies. And he's regarded as a conservative Republican. He's a moderate. Again, his wife was from a slaveholding family. He's originally from Kentucky, lived in Illinois, had never really said anything that irritated too many people. Of course, he had that famous House Divided speech. But, you know, this is a guy that said he's not going to interfere with slavery where it already exists. All he wants to do is prohibit slavery in the territories. You know, he's kind of this, seemed as like this homespun kind of guy from the West. So he was seen as a guy that maybe some Southerners will support. Of course, they're fooling themselves. But Lincoln was a guy that didn't have too many black marks against him in 1860. At least that was the impression that the Republicans had. And they thought that this guy could definitely be a candidate that would have support even outside of the Republican Party. Again, they're going to be wrong. But doesn't hurt anything to try, at least I guess they thought. Now, the Constitutional Union Party, again, had John Bell of Tennessee. Now, they're actually going to nominate Bell 1 week before the Republicans met. So it's a splinter party, has conservative Whigs, know-nothings. And the idea was that they were going to support the Constitution as it stood and enforcement of the law. Now, what does that mean? No one really knows, but support the Constitution and enforce the law. Again, pretty vague terms. They hoped, though, that what they could do by forming this Constitutional Union Party was to pull conservatives away from the Republicans and minimize the effect, potential effect of secession by actually having the Republicans defeated in November of 1860. The idea of the Constitutional Union Party wasn't to win. It was to lead to Republican defeat, to hope that the Democrats would be able to stay together and not have the Republicans win. Because everyone in the Union knew one thing, at least looking back on this now, that if the Republicans won, there would be some serious problems. We often don't place the blame for secession on the Republican Party. It's the Democrats, it's the South that seceded. But the blame should really be placed on the Republican Party. They're the ones that led to secession. It's the ultimate election of Republican, a purely sectional candidate that's going to lead to secession. And it's the Republican Party that should shoulder the blame of secession if you're going to have a blame game here. The Republican Party led to it. It had no chance of winning in the South. And once you have a purely sectional party win, the South says to themselves, what the heck are we doing in this union? We're done. You've got people that have said John Brown is Jesus Christ. You've got people that are completely against our ideas on political economy. You've got people that don't believe in the Constitution, in essence. I mean, that's what these Democrats are saying. The Republicans don't believe in the Constitution. If they did, they support the Dred Scott decision. But they don't. So they're not trustworthy. We can't trust these people. Who's to say in a few years they're not going to say, well, I know we said we're just going to contain slavery in the South. We're just going to abolish it there. And not only that, these states, they're just an obstacle. Get them out of the way. Our political economy, our Hamiltonian system, you're going to take it. We're going to spoon it down your throat and you're going to like it. Take your medicine. So Democrats or Southerners, I should say, are saying enough. Now, Lincoln's going to get 180 electoral college votes, which is enough to win. He gets short of 2 million votes. Douglas is going to get 12 electoral college votes, almost as many popular votes as Lincoln, but only 12 electoral college votes. Breckinridge is actually going to get 72 electoral college votes and less than a million votes, whereas Bell will get 39 electoral college votes and less than 600,000 votes. So as you can see, Lincoln gets the majority of the electoral college and a plurality of the popular votes. But when you look at it even further, again, if you were to do a man on the street, take a microphone out and say, what percentage of the population did Lincoln get in 1860? Probably most people are going to say, oh, you know, 85%, 90%. This is Lincoln. This is the great hero of the war, the guy that saved the Union. I mean, all these Southerners are just evil people, treasonous, traitors, and they're just leaving the Union. They had no cause to do this. Well, Lincoln only got 39% of the vote. 39% of the popular vote. This is the smallest number since John Quincy Adams became president in 1825, and of course the 1824 election. 39%, the great hero, never got 50% of the vote. Now, he did get 50% in 1864, but if you put the South back in it, he wouldn't have gotten 50% of the vote. This is a guy that didn't have any support in the South. He wasn't even on the ballot in Southern states. So how can this guy be considered the great American hero that he is when the majority of Americans didn't want him as president? They didn't think he was a good idea. This is crazy. It's almost lunacy to have this impression of Abraham Lincoln like we have today. But it's what survived because, of course, the North won the war. Now, as a result of Lincoln's election, South Carolina is going to secede from the Union on December 20th, 1860. So Lincoln's elected in November of 1860. South Carolina will almost immediately start plans for a secession convention. Now, we often think of these things as, and sometimes historians will portray them in the wrong way. These secession conventions were popularly elected by the people of South Carolina and the people of the southern states. They were not arbitrary. The governor did not assign it. There wasn't some dictatorial rule here. The people elected the convention, and the convention could make their own choice. In this particular case, of course, South Carolina is going to unanimously secede because they had already talked about it before in the 1830s. They talked about it in 1850. I mean, this is the last straw for them. Abraham Lincoln, a sectional candidate, this is crazy to them. So there's no way they're going to stay in the Union. So South Carolina will pass an ordinance of secession, which rescinds their 1788 ratification of the United States Constitution. Essentially, what they're doing here, again, they're rescinding the ratification. What they're saying is the people of South Carolina ratified this United States Constitution in 1788. We are rescinding that ratification. So we often use the term secession, but basically what they're doing is saying that Constitution is no longer effect in our state. We were allowed to ratify it. It was a compact among the states. The other states now have violated the compact because they don't believe in the Constitution anymore. And we are now rescinding our ratification. We're able to do that. And of course, if you look back at the history of the Constitution, that's essentially the way it was done. States ratified it. The states are all over the document. So states had the authority, the people of the states here. And that's what they've done. The people of the states, the people of the South Carolina selected a secession convention. That secession convention then seceded from the Union, rescinded their ratification of the Constitution, and now South Carolina is an independent republic. If you don't think that can happen, then you don't believe in the American principle, which is independence, liberty. Of course, this is exactly what the states were doing in 1776 when they all essentially seceded from the British Empire. In fact, a couple of states did it on their own. There wasn't this one mass nation in 1776. The states, as Jefferson said in the Declaration, were seceding independently. It's just they did it in common cause. So, this is exactly what happens here in 1788, and Southerners are well aware of this. They were doing exactly what their ancestors had done in 1776. Now, Buchanan, who's still president, now, even though we've had a presidential election, James Buchanan is still president. He declares secession illegal, but he's not going to use force to stop it. And see, this is where Buchanan is an interesting guy, a guy that should be more respected for his actions here. He could have sent in the army in 1860. He could have done exactly what Andrew Jackson said he was going to do during the nullification crisis in the 1830s. He could have used force, but Buchanan says, no, I'm not going to. Buchanan was trying to save the Union. How many states have seceded in 1860? One. Every other state is still in the Union. So by sending troops in and using force, Buchanan knows full well what's going to happen. Other states are going to secede. So what he's saying is, all right, we've got one state out of the Union. We can probably solve this crisis. We're just going to have to come up with some kind of compromise. We're not going to be able to do this right now. If I send in force, if I say I'm going to send in the troops, well, then I'm destroying the Union. So Buchanan should be ranked much higher than he is by presidential historians for his actions here. He's often seen as weak. Oh, well, he didn't send in the army like Lincoln did, the great hero to save the Union. Buchanan said, if I send in the army, I'm destroying the Union. He was exactly right. Compromise would have saved the Union. Sending in the army, like Lincoln does, destroys the Union, and particularly destroys the Union of the Founders. So, let's talk about what happens here. The time between December 20th, 1860, and April 12th, 1861, which is a firing on Fort Sumter, is called secession winter. So, you're going to have a number of states secede from the Union. In fact, up until the firing on Fort Sumter, you're only going to have seven. So seven states were out, but it wasn't so clear again in December 1860 that six other states would leave the Union. It was thought maybe South Carolina is going to act alone, and if we can have a compromise, we'll be able to bring South Carolina back in. They'll rescind this ordinance of secession, and they'll come back in the Union. The question is, though, was war inevitable at this point? And I would say definitely not. There was no clear majority that would say war is coming, unless you're William H. Seward with the irrepressible conflict. No, I mean, there were people that thought, we can save this Union. It can still be done. War doesn't have to happen. In fact, James Buchanan didn't think it had to happen. Abraham Lincoln's going to make it happen. So was war inevitable? The answer is clearly no. War did not have to happen. That's why this is often called by Northern Democrats Mr. Lincoln's War. It was his war. The burden of the war should be placed on Abraham Lincoln, not the South. And I think that's something that we have to reassess in America if we were able to do that, if we could do that. I think people would look at this war a little differently. Could war have been prevented? Absolutely. Abraham Lincoln could have prevented this war every step of the way, but he is doing everything he can. Now, he'll say, I don't want war, et cetera, et cetera. But he's doing really everything he can to bring about this war. Every step he takes is another step towards war. His actions prove it throughout these months leading up to his inauguration, then even after that point. So Lincoln could have stopped the war before it even began. He's president-elect. His words and his actions are going to have an impact. Now, there were a number of compromise proposals put forth during this time period. In fact, the Senate is going to form something called the Committee of 13. Now, on this committee, there were 8 Democrats and 5 Republicans. And they're going to hear a number of compromise proposals. Now, in fact, the chair of the committee, Jefferson Davis, came up with something called the dual majorities. Because there were 8 Democrats, they could have passed any compromise measure that came through. They could have put it forward. But Davis says, no, in order for any compromise proposal to pass, we have to have a majority of the Republicans, 3, and a majority of the Democrats, 5. So we're going to have 8, but 3 of those 8 have to be Republicans. So that way it's not just a Democrat proposal. The most interesting proposal to come through was something called the Crittenden proposal, the Crittenden Compromise. The Crittenden Compromise would have added a number of unamendable amendments to the Constitution that would have protected slavery in the South, that would have extended the Missouri Compromise line to California. The idea was to come up with a plan that would appease the South and make it to where they would still stay in the Union. When this Crittenden Compromise was put to a vote in the Committee of 13, all 8 Democrats were for it, all 5 Republicans were against it. And this is the way with every single compromise proposal that was put forward. All the Democrats supported it, all the Republicans rejected it. So here are the Republicans acting as obstructionists. They don't have a majority. But yet, because of this dual majority idea that Jefferson Davis put forward, he wanted Republican support. And he wanted Republican support because if he could get Republican support, then this whole crisis can be avoided. We can actually put this thing to bed, and no longer do we have to talk about this issue. Now, why did the Republicans reject it? Because of Abraham Lincoln. This guy is telling all his governors, all the governors-elect, all the people he can talk to, do not compromise. Do not compromise. Don't compromise with the South. Don't compromise with the Democrats. Don't do it. And you're thinking to yourself, wait a second here. This guy wants to support the Union, wants to save the Union. Why is he telling people not to compromise? Because Lincoln knew full well that if he was to compromise, the Republican Party is going to be destroyed. There's no more issue for the Republican Party. They can go back to talking about Hamiltonian economics and all this kind of stuff. But if the slavery extension issue is dead in the territories, there's no more Republican Party. It's gone. Perhaps you would have a reformation of the Whig Party. Perhaps the Republicans would have stuck around, but the Democrats would have gotten back together again. They would have solidified again behind their ideas of political economy. And, of course, the Republican Party is dead. They're never going to win another election. So, again, Republicans say no compromise. Lincoln is saying no compromise. In fact, Crittenden comes up with a great idea. Let's put it to the people. Let's do something. This is extraordinary time. We're talking about secession. We're talking about potential war. Let's have the people of the United States vote on this thing. That's rejected. So when the Republicans reject this Crittenden Compromise, Democrats, 2 Democrats, including Davis, will switch their votes and it will go down in defeat, 7-6. So actually 2 Democrats voted against it. There's also something called the Washington Peace Conference of 1861. Here you have some of the mid-Atlantic states, principally in some of the upper southern states, states like Virginia, call a peace conference. The idea was to bring in some of the most conservative members of America and try to, again, come up with a compromise that everyone's going to support. It's ineffective. These guys can't get anything done because you have Republicans who are not going to budge. And that was the real issue. Republicans were not willing to budge every step of the way. Democrats were willing to compromise. Republicans were not. So who shoulders the blame of secession? Who shoulders the blame of the time leading this war? Definitely the Republicans, not the Democrats. Of course, again, if compromise happens, Lincoln is going to be a one-term president. He chooses party over union. He's not a union guy. He's a party man. If he wanted to save the union, he could have here. The union could have been saved. Only one state has seceded. One state. Every other state is still in the union. If he wants to save the union, he can do it. Lincoln doesn't want to.